Good morning, and we have two things ahead of us. First, we will finish the section on sorting and look in more detail at merge sort, and then I will move on to binary trees. So, merge sort comes in two variants. The well-known one is the top-down one. So how does that work? It has a top function. It has an auxiliary function merge that simply merges two lists from the front. So if one of them is empty, of course you return the other one, and otherwise, if they're both non-empty, you compare the first two elements x and y and put the smaller one in front and merge the rest. And then merge sort is simply a top-down version that, given lists, splits the list in two halves and sorts them recursively and then merges them with this auxiliary function. So this is exactly what happens here. We first take the length of the list, and if that length is 0 or 1, then this list is already sorted, and otherwise we merge the two recursively sorted lists where we've used the take function and the drop function to either take the first n diff two elements or drop the first n diff two elements from the list. So this is quite nice from an analysis point of view. It's pretty obvious that it has the required complexity. We'll get to that in a moment. But it's not perfect from an efficiency point of view. For example, here you traverse the list every time you you go down one level, you traverse the list three times to compute the length and to take and to drop. It can be improved, and we will do some of that in the homework and some of it later on in the lecture by using a different version. But at least that's the standard from a functional point of view, certainly obviously correct one. So we're not going to bother with the correctness, that it sorts and that the multi-set of elements is the same. We will look instead at the complexity proof. And so in complete analogy with the functions here, the merge functions and the merge sort function, we define two functions, cmerge and cmsort, that don't compute the time, but they compute the number of comparisons that the function merge or the function merge sort makes when given the certain input lists. So I'm not showing you the definitions. They are fairly obvious from the, you simply take those definitions that you have, and instead of actually computing the output list, you just count the number of comparisons. Let's assume that they are clear how they are defined, and then based on those, you can compute the number of comparisons merge sort needs in order to compute its result. And so let's first, just intuitively, we're not going to prove this formally, figure out what is the number of comparisons that merge requires given two lists, X's and Y's. I'll show you the, this is the definition of merge again at the top of the slide. So if you have two lists, X's and Y's, can you either precisely or can you estimate the number of comparisons it takes? That's a bit too optimistic. You have to do a bit more. You may have to do more than the minimum of the two lists. That's a good starting point. So it's
sum of the lengths.
Yes. In the worst case, you can have the sum of the length. So this is an upper bound. You don't get a precise result by taking length, but upper bounds are good enough for us. And then you will get, with the help of that lemma, you will get this little theorem that first looks a bit confusing, because it says here the number of comparisons of merged sorts is something with a 2 to the k in it, and you use something like n log n. But we're making the simplifying assumption here that the length of the list is actually a power of 2, because otherwise the proof gets more complicated. And then the this is, in fact, the 2 to the k is the length of the list, and the k is the logarithm of the length. So it's just the usual n log n. It just looks funny. And how would you prove that? Just the proof principle? Yes, but on what? Yeah, it's a reduction on K. So it's a quite a straightforward natural number induction. So that was goes through quite smoothly, but as I already indicated, at least from the constant in the complexity, we can do better. Because we are, of course, when we say here the number of comparisons, we completely ignore constants like if you take the length of the list, that doesn't cost any comparisons, but of course you still have to traverse the list, and so therefore this is a fairly optimistic estimate, and lots of other costs is swept under the carpet here. You can do a more refined analysis, and then you will just see that it's still of that order, but the constant grows if you count other things too. So it's okay, but we can do a bit better in practical terms. And we're not going to look at it, actually. So instead, we will look at the bottom-up version of merge sort, which isn't so well known. How does that work? So here we have the main function is merge sort underscore bottom up. How does that work? Well, if the list is empty, then of course you don't do anything. But otherwise, you first map this function lambda x singleton list of x over the whole input list. That is, you turn the input list from a list of elements into a list of singleton lists. And then you call a function merge all that gradually merges these lists in a pyramid. In the first sweep over the list, it'll merge all the adjacent ones, and then we'll go over the list again, merge all the adjacent ones until there is only a single list in the list. And then we're done, that's the result. So. How does merge all work? Well, it does what I just explained. We are at the end, that is, we have just a single list, and of course inside merge all is always applied to a list of lists, so inside we have a single list, and that's the result then. But if we have more than one list, then we first have a first pass of merging all the adjacent ones, so you go over the whole list, XSS, so it's a list of lists, and then you recursively merge again. So that's like a loop. You keep on calling this merge adjacent and doing that again and again until you're just left with a single list. And there is one line missing. So what's the difference? Why do I put in this line that says merge all for the applied to the empty list is undefined? Why can't I just drop that? What's the difference? There is a significant difference. Yeah.
Well, then the second case would also be pattern matched against the empty list.
Right. And so that means if you call this one on the emptiness, it's actually a non-terminating function, whereas this is undefined, which may be something very different. It may it give you some value, but you don't know which one. And so you may well program it like this and say, oh, I don't care about the empty, what happens in the empty list, because it's never called with the empty list. But the problem is, if you want to give this to Isabel, it'll complain. It says, I can't prove the termination of this function. And indeed, it is not terminating. And so you really have to put in that additional undefined case by hand. That's one of the rare situations where you would have to add such a clause. And then the merge adjacent is quite straightforward. It goes over the list. If the list is empty, there's nothing to merge. If it's a singleton, there's again nothing to merge. But if you have at least two lists in there, X's and Y's, in the front, then you merge those here, and then you recursively merge the adjacent ones in the list. So it's just a single traversal of that list, merging pairs of adjacent lists. So, any questions about the functionality here? Then let's analyze it. And again, I'm not going to go into the correctness proof, the functional correctness proof. I will look at the counting of the number of comparisons. And again, we will do it fairly high level, but not quite as high level as next. Last time we'll do it in a bit more detail. But still, we assume we have functions that count the number of comparisons in merge adjacent, merge all, and merge sort bottom up. So those have been defined, and they do what you expect them to do. Now, this is the theorem that we expect to get out, and that can be proved. It's exactly the same theorem as before, so we see we have the same complexity here. The number of comparisons of the in the bottom-up merge sort is again bounded by k times 2 to the k if the list is of length 2 to the k. And so it seems there's no improvement, that of course the improvement is that we have got rid of quite a bit of the additional work that the previous version you needed to do for computing the length and the take and the drop, which didn't count into the comparisons because neither length nor take nor drop compare anything. So that's why we don't see the difference. But if you actually run them, you will find that this one is depending on the exact details, like 30 to 50% faster. So let's look for a moment in more detail at the proof of this one. So if you remind yourself what, so of course, merge, all these comparison functions are defined in complete analogy with the actual functions. So if you want to know how many comparisons merge sort bottom up does, let's go back to the actual function. Merge sort bottom up is completely defined in terms of how many comparisons the merge all does. So this is the key question, merge all on a list, how many comparisons will merge all make? So we need, in order to prove this lemma here, so let's write that down. This is our goal, length of x is 2 to the k, implies that comparison of merge sort bottom up of x is necessary equal k times 2 to the k. So then we can go back to the code. It's always good to have the code in front of you when you want to do some analysis of it. And so this function is therefore defined completely in terms of the comparison for merge all. And now we'll have to guess a suitable bound or exact number, but it'll be a bound. And we will, this is not quite correct. Here we have not a list, but we have a list of lists, so I should be using
the identifiers consistently. So this is a list of lists, and we merge all of them in this in these repeated traversals where we merge adjacent ones. And question is, how much does that cost? And again, we make this this assumption. And now, either can you make a suggestion what the right-hand side should be, or maybe do we need a bit more information about this list to make a reasonable estimate for the number of comparisons? So what you should think of is that this is now a list of lists, and we know how many lists are in there, but is that enough to estimate the cost for merging all of them? Or should we know a bit more? Yeah?
We assume that only consists of single lists, and it should be the same part as well.
Right. But if we only assume that it's single lists, we will get into problems with the induction, because then in the induction step, we will have too weak an induction hypothesis, because in the next step there won't be single lists anymore. So can you strengthen this idea of all of them being single lists? Can you generalize it? What will be an invariant of this algorithm that's maintained by each pass of merge adjacent, in fact? Yeah.
So every time you use merge adjacent, you have to merge x's and y's. So, and that has a bound of two length, or two times the length, right?
Yes.
Or the sum of length. So could you, every time you do that, which is k, or two k times, times all that, times
this is getting too complicated. I just want a generalization of this idea that all of the lists have length 1 in order to be able to perform this inductive proof.
Every element has length more than 1? Has length more than 1?
Well, that's in the second step, but that will, if it has more than 1, that's terribly that's not precise enough to tell you anything about the merge. But what will be the, when you perform merge adjacent, you start out with lists, a list of lists where they all have the length 1. Now you perform one application of merge adjacent on them. So what's the next one? What property does it have? They all have length 2, and then length 4. So what's the general situation? Right, so now you're being too clever. Let's be simple. They all have the same length. That's sufficient. And they all have some length m. So we know this. It's 2 to the power of k many lists. And for all the lists in there, we have that their length is some m. We don't actually need to care what that m is. But then, of course, the m will appear here, but that doesn't matter. That's not that. So then, now you know this, can you now give me an estimate how many comparisons does it take to merge all of them if there are 2 to the k many and each of them has length m? That's, of course, that's now pure intuition. Did you have an intuition that helps you there? But that's not quite, that's not enough, because it doesn't just depend on the number of lists in there, but also on their length, and how does their length come into it?
Just a guess, but maybe as if we first have lists of length 1, and then lists of length 2, and then lists of length 4, maybe multiply, so I have to take the end time.
Yeah, that's precisely what happens. Good intuition. So, I think what you could probably do, and this is one way of doing it, but just the suggestions that came from Jürgen's earlier, where we are more precise about this length, maybe this length can actually be something like 2 to the k minus something, because you start out with one very long list of singleton lists, and then you, in each step, you get half as many lists, but they grow they double in size. So maybe you can find a more precise formula. I'm not sure. Yeah. But let's assume this is what we're trying to prove. And now, how would we prove this? Well, let's prove it in the usual fashion by an induction over the recursion of this function definition. And this function definition will be defined by exactly the same recursion scheme as this one here, the merge all. So let's just go through this. So proof by computation induction on C merge all. And so you have the two base cases, which are uninteresting, and so we just look at this last line here. And we assume, of course, that XSS is not empty and it's not singleton. So that would be, in Isabel terminology, number 3, the case 3, because it's the third equation. And and the definition, which you don't see, but it's completely obvious from that definition, is it's how many comparisons does it take? Well, all the comparisons that this function takes, so it's C, merge adjacent of the XSS plus, and then the number of comparisons that merge all takes, but now on the result of merge. And let's call that XSS prime. And what is XSS prime? It's defined as the merge adjacent of XSS. Okay, so what do we do first? Let's first try and get an estimate for this one. How expensive is it to perform merge adjacent in this situation? And so you would need a separate lemma, but I'm not even going to write down the lemma. Let's just on the fly conjecture what that should be. So, can you give an upper bound for that? The merge adjacent of a list of a certain length, where all of the lists inside have that length.
And of course, we know what merge adjacent does. It just calls the merge function, and we know a bound for the merge function. Remember this. If you just merge two lists, then it has that cost. And we know the lists that we merge all have length n. So think again about this term. Yeah. Yes. Why? Because you're merging pairs. How many pairs? 2 to the k minus 1 pairs. But each pair to merge takes time 2 times n, because you're merging two lists of length m. And so in the end, you get m times 2 to the k, plus, of course, the remainder term here. C merge all of x s s prime. And now here we can use the induction hypothesis, because this is the recursive call. So this is, by induction hypothesis, this stays the same, and this one, unless I'm getting it all wrong, should be k minus 1 times 2 to the k minus 1. Why is that? Because what we have done, we have applied it to a list. That's the result of merge adjacent. So how long is that list? The list is only half as long as the previous one. That's the 2 to the k minus 1. And I missed out the term here. What was I missing? 2m. Yeah, because what's happened in the recursive call, you have the length of the total list has just halved, so that's why we have the k minus 1 in both places. This is the thing that we're comparing ourselves with. And the m has doubled, the size of all the lists has doubled, but the number of lists has halved, and so instead of this one, we get this one. And if you now start adding things up, the 2 times, you get k up here, and unless I'm mistaken, this should be equal, actually. I'm not going to do the arithmetic in front of you, it shouldn't be hard, m times k times 2 to the k, which is precisely what it's supposed to be up here. So, from a technical point of view, conducting this proof is nothing new. It's as many of the other inductive proofs that we've seen before. It's just maybe a bit lengthier, and there were some more lemmas involved where you had to speculate the right upper bounds. But the machinery that we're using is still the same machinery, and I just wanted to show you that it can also be used not just to argue about the functional correctness, but you can also argue about time, or you can argue about other things that you want to count, like the number of comparisons. Right, and I think that brings us to the end of the merge sort section. Any last questions on this? Well, it's not quite the end. We can do a little bit better. We're not going to do so here, but just as an idea of how that can be improved. And the from the bottom-up merge sort to this improved one is just a small step, and the small step says make use of already sorted subsequences, because it's purely from an information theoretic point of view, it's very unlikely that the list will be completely unsorted, and so there will always be sub sequences that will be increasing or decreasing, and so why don't we make use of those? And I'm not going to the details of the code, but just showing you the idea. What we're currently doing with the bottom-up merge sort, if this is our example, then we start with this list. We just make every element a singleton list, and then we start pairwise merging. Don't do that, but instead, when you go through the list and instead of making each one a singleton list, already recognize that there is an increasing or decreasing subsequence, and turn your start already into this thing that you start with already into this one. So you recognize this is a decreasing subsequence that you start with, and you have to turn that around. So there's a little bit of a cost for reversing that subsequence, but on the other hand, it's less expensive, it's linear, compared to doing all the merges, which is n log n. Then you start with this one, and here you have an increasing subsequence, which you can just leave as is, and then you start your merging process from there, and you may have already saved quite a few of the initial passes. And in fact, there is a formalization of that in the Archive of Formal Proofs, our big repository, which is close to, I think, 2 million lines of proofs and code. And this is, in fact, an example motivated by real code. So this code is the standard merge, the standard sorting function in the Haskell library, or one of the Haskell libraries, the base library, I think. So this isn't just for demonstration purposes. This is real code. That's the end of lists and sorting. And now we move on to the most important data structure in this course, the binary trees. And so we've already seen some of it, but we'll go over it again in a bit more structured fashion. So this is what we'll certainly do today, just introduce binary trees again with some basic functions, and then go over a bit of combinatorics on binary trees. Okay, so they already are in the library, and you can load them from there, and they are defined like this. To remind you, a tree can either be a leaf node, which means it's empty, or it's a proper node, which consists of a left subtree, an element, and the right subtree. And the notational abbreviations that I will use are these. Instead of the leaf, I will just write open angular bracket, close angular bracket, and instead of the node, I will often write this triple here. And most of the time when I talk about trees, I will mean binary trees. And then there are lots of predefined functions, a number of predefined functions, and you should know about those. There's the in-order function that traverses the tree in order. So if you have a node, it takes the left subtree first, then the element, and then the right subtree. And then there is also a pre-order and a post-order traversal, which do things just in a different order. Then there's a size function, very important, tells you the number of nodes. So the size of the leaf is zero, and the size of a node is of a tree consisting that starts with a node is the size of the subtrees plus one for the node itself. And there's an additional function called size one, which you can, and I will often read as number of leaves, and because, this is the definition, this is one possible definition, that it's just the original size plus one, but it turns out that from this definition you get this recursion equation that for each leaf It counts one, and for each node, it just adds up the sizes of the subtrees, which in essence means it's counting the number of leaves. That's a simple consequence of this definition. So this is an easy numeric relationship, and if you think in terms of the two constructors, then size is counting the number of nodes, size one is counting the number of leaves, and they're just distinct by one. And this is not something you should type into your system. You should really use size one and size. This is just abbreviation on the slides to make the text more compact. Height, it's clear what the height is, except that's the one thing that's usually not uniformly defined, because some people start at zero and some people start at one. And so this is how we define our height. A leaf has height zero, and a node has the maximum of the heights of the subtrees plus one. Again, I have some notational convention here. The real function is called height. On the slides, I will just write, and on the board, I will just write h to keep the notation more compact. And then there are some obvious lemmas about the height, that of course the height is bounded by the size. And then this is one of these standard lemmas that you learn about in any discrete structures course, that the number of leaves is bounded by 2 to the height of the tree. And in this course, we will also use something I call the minimal height, where the definition is almost exactly like this, but we take the minimum rather than the maximum of the two heights. And basically, by the height, you can think of as the longest path from the root to a leaf, and the minimum height is the shortest path from the root to a leaf. And of course, the minimum height is less or equal than the height. And here we have the opposite phenomenon, that the 2 to the minimum height is a lower bound for the number of leaves of the tree. So here, the height was, 2 to the height was an upper bound for the number of leaves, and 2 to the minimum height is a lower bound for the number of leaves. And now we are moving towards balanced trees, search trees, but we need to be, I would like to be a bit more precise about what balanced and what complete means. It's used fairly loosely often. We will give it a precise meaning. So we call a tree complete if it looks exactly like a triangle. So you could think of, all the leaves are at the same depth, but that's one way of defining it, but we're defining it recursively like this. The leaf is complete, and the node is complete if and only if both subtrees are complete and have the same height. So that's just another alternative definition. And then it's not too difficult to show that a tree is complete if and only if the height and the minimum height are exactly the same. So normally you will have a tree if you look at the lower border, then it could be something like this. And the complete trees are ideals like this. And then you get some easy corollaries. If a tree is complete, then really the number of leaves is exactly 2 to the height. Also the other way around, if you have that relationship between the number of leaves and the height, then it must be a complete tree. And the same thing with the minimal height, because of course the two things are the same. So if this correspondence holds for the minimum height, then it's also a complete tree. And if it's not complete tree, then we know that the number of leaves is strictly smaller than the height. And the other way around as well. So this is the upper bound side, this is the lower bound side. If it's not complete, then there are strictly more leaves than 2 to the minimum height. Because, see, this would be here, we had something that the minimum height would be like this, and then this would tell us here we would get, when we use this minimum height, we would get an estimate from the number of leaves of this complete subtree, but there are more subtrees, they extend further, and so this is in fact a lower bound, and it must be greater than that. And finally, we call technically, we will use balance sometimes a bit loosely and sometimes quite precisely. If you want to say use it precisely, then I call a tree balanced if the height and the minimum height differ by at most one. So remember that we are on natural numbers, so it doesn't actually matter whether it's natural numbers or integers, it would work for integers as well, because the height is always greater or equal to the minimum height, so if you subtract them, you should have always a non-negative number, and it balanced means it's less or equal one, so either they are the same or they're just one apart. And then let's just, as a bit of an exercise, look at a little lemma that tells us if a tree is balanced, that tells us that balanced trees have optimal height. So if you have a balanced tree and you have some other tree, T prime, that has more nodes, or at least as many nodes, then the height of T prime is at least as large as the height of T. So that's what means have optimal height, meaning among all the trees of the same size, this one will have, the balanced one will have the smallest height. And that, of course, is the main justification why we want balanced trees for searching, because if you have search trees, then the height of the tree indicates, in the worst case, how long you will have to search if you have an ordered tree, and therefore you want to minimize that time, and this tells us if you balance your tree, then you have achieved minimal height amongst all the trees. Of course, you can't always make the tree complete because the number of nodes that you have may not be a power of 2, but you could always at least make it balanced. Of course, as you all know from previous courses, that would be too expensive in practice to make it really balanced. So one usually works with approximations of balance, but this is the optimum that that you can achieve, that you could achieve. And so let's just look at this little combinatorial lemma, and this is what we're going to show. So I'll just copy it because we will go back to the previous slide. And what? And the size of T is less than equal to the size of T prime. Then the height of T will also be less than equal to the height of T prime. And balance just meant difference of at most one between the height and the minimum height. And quite a few of those lemmas are proved by induction over the trees. This one actually isn't, so it's a bit of a change. Here we'll just do a case analysis, and so proof by cases. And let's look at the first case. What is the thing that we distinguish on? It's whether the tree is complete or not. Okay, why does it work in the case that T is complete?
Well,
then we know this, that's the first lemma up there, that the number of leaves is 2 to the height. And I'm claiming, well, not I'm claiming here, I think I missed. It doesn't matter, sorry. Yeah, it's exactly what we're, yeah. From this assumption, if this is less or equal to this, then of course the size plus 1 will also be less than or equal. And how can we bound this? It's not on the slide. We can bound this from above by 2 what? Yep, exactly. Okay, and now we have an inequation between two powers of the same base, and so of course we have I of t is less than equal. Second case, not complete T. And here, a little bit longer, we first make a side remark, so to speak. It's not complete, so by the last lemma, 2 to the minimum height is strictly less than the number of leaves. And now we can use this inequation again, that's less than or equal the number of leaves of T prime. And then we can use again our bounding idea, that's therefore 2 to the height of T prime. Okay, so therefore, of course, we get that the minimum height of T is strictly less than the height of T prime. So that's the same idea as above, but it doesn't. We need one more step. Where does this come from? Yes, that's exactly it. By balanced T and not complete T. If it were complete, they would be the same, but there can be a part only at most one, and now we know they're a part exactly one. And that, if we call this one here star, and now from this equation, with the help of star, we should get that the height of T is actually less or equal the height of T prime. Why is that? I looked at it earlier and got confused, but I think it makes sense. The height of T is this one, and this is minimum height plus 1, and we know the minimum height plus 1 will be less or equal the height of T prime. So yes, it's exactly called follows exactly from this star. So again, this isn't really different from something you may have seen in undergraduate lectures. It's just that you can really define all of these terms precisely in the proof assistant and then do your combinatorics in a completely formal way. That'll be the end of the combinatorics interlude. We will occasionally use some of these lemmas, but it won't be a major emphasis of the course. But it's it's good to know that you could, in principle, also go in that direction and do a lot more combinatorics on trees. And a little bit of a warning here: the terminology is not standardized in the literature. So if people talk about complete or balanced, you have to look very carefully at what they mean. And for example, Drew's course complete what we call balanced. If you look in Wikipedia, you will again get something that may not be exactly this. I think we just have to live with the fact that different authors have different preferences. And now we come back to, or we start with a completely new chapter, namely search trees. And that will keep us busy for the next couple of weeks. We will look at a number of different schemes for search trees, and they will all fit under a sort of a common umbrella, and this common umbrella is what I want to talk about today mostly, but still, using a particularly simple scheme, namely unbalanced search trees. And so you see here we start with the unbalanced search trees, then we step back a little bit and look at search trees as abstract data types, and then we look at two instances in detail, the 2-3 trees and the red-black trees, and then there'll be a short overview over more search trees. And finally, something really quite cute, that I only found out about a couple of years ago, how to define union, intersection, and difference on binary search trees efficiently. So these ones will only be concerned with insertion and deletion of single elements, and then this will be a generic method for upgrading to these set-based operations. And finally, it's quite a different scheme for search tree, so-called tries and Patricia tries. Right, so yes, I already said that. And what are binary search trees really? Abstractly, they are concrete representations of sets. Why? Well, you can map any tree back to the set of elements in there, and that's one of the basic functions called setTree, and it's defined in the obvious manner. It just collects all the elements in the node, in the nodes of the tree. So it just goes recursively through the trees, so it collects the left subtree, the right subtree, and the element itself. And the binary search trees represents a set that can be searched in the time O of the height of the tree. So again, this is the importance of the height. Of course, this is just, we haven't proved anything like this, but that's common folklore that you all know about, so I'm just recalling it. And now we take a step back and we say, well, set tree isn't just a special function, it's actually an instance of a very general function that we will find in a number of situations, namely a so-called abstraction function that mediates between two abstraction levels, a concrete implementation level and an abstract specification level. And the abstraction function takes you back from your concrete implementation level to a more abstract mathematical model. And this is exactly what's happening here. It takes a tree, that's your representation of the data, into an abstract mathematical object set. These functions are usually called abstraction functions, and they play a central role when you want to show that the implementation that you've got actually is a correct implementation. And in addition to this abstraction function, in order to argue about binary search trees, you need the invariant that they are search trees in the sense that they are ordered, defined like this. So, of course, the node, a leaf is always ordered, and the node is a binary search tree if both subtrees are binary search trees, and all the elements in the left subtree are less than the elements in the middle, and all the elements in the right subtrees are bigger than the elements in the middle. So we've seen this already. I'm just recalling this. This is the standard definition of a binary search tree. And again, we implicitly, when we talk about binary search trees, we assume that the type A here is in the class linear order. So you have this ordering relation on it, and the ordering relation actually is a linear ordering. And if you take numbers, for example, they are linear orders. So what's the interface to our data type of, or to our implementation of the set data type? That's really what you should think of it. Trees represent sets, and what is the interface? How are we allowed to use trees? Well, of course, this is the generic set interface that a priori has nothing to do with trees. Trees may be a specific instance of that interface, but if you just want to expose the interface, you don't say that trees are in there. You just say what's in there, namely some type S. I've called it S for sets. That's the implementation type that represents your sets. And then the standard operations on sets, namely an empty set, an insert function, a delete function, both of them take an element and a set and give you back a new set, and an isIn function that looks if the element that you give it is in the set that you give it. So this is the abstract interface. This has a priori nothing to do with sets. This is just some functions that operate on some type S, which we don't know yet, and have certain names that are suggestive of sets. But at the moment, it's just an interface without any specification. The specification will come in a moment. And this is our standard set interface. So whenever somebody implements a set, those four functions have to be present with those functionalities. You could also work with maps rather than sets, and in practice, maps are at least as useful as sets, but they're just a tiny bit more, more verbose. So a map interface would look like this, if you want to implement maps from A to B, you would have some implementation type, call it M. You would have an empty map. You would have an update function that takes an element in the domain, an element in the range, and a map, and gives you back a new map that has been updated to map that element to this result. Then you would have a delete function that removes an element from the domain of the map and gives you a smaller map. And then you have, instead of an isIn function, you have a lookup function that takes a map and a domain element and gives you back an optional range element, meaning optional because it could be that this domain element that you give it, this map is not defined on, and then it would return none. So this would be the map interface, which I'm just showing you here, but I'm not going to use. We will always concentrate on sets and this interface. But you can see it's a direct upgrade. And of course, you could always work with maps, and then sets would be a special case. So sets are just specifications of maps, not the other way around, but we just focus on the shorter specification. So we haven't got to the specification yet. So far, I've just shown you the interface, and then I'm showing you the implementation, and only then will we discuss the specification. But before I show you the implementation, how do we compare elements? We used to compare them with less than and less than or equal. I will now do it slightly differently. Namely, I assume that the type is a linear order, and I will define a new data type, comparison value, LT for less than, EQ for EQ, and GT for greater than. So that's a standard method. And then we assume we have a comparison function, which we can actually define. This is not an efficient definition of it, but you could define the comparison function like that. If x is less than y, then you return the less than constructor. If x is equal to y, the EQ constructor, and otherwise the greater than constructor. Of course, for specific types, the hardware or some programming tricks may enable you to avoid these double comparisons and directly give you one of these three. That's not something that I'm interested in. So I just assume we have this comparison function yielding these types, this is one possible naive implementation of it. But it's nicer to work with these three outcomes instead of these nested if-then-else, simply for the layout of the code. And now we look at unbalanced binary search trees, which we had already covered in one of the previous lectures. So I will go through it quickly. So the implementation we start with. So here the implementation type is just our type of trees. Empty is just implemented as the leaf. Insert function, here is the insert function with the comparison function going to the three outcomes, less than, EQ, and greater than. And you see the code is just, the layout of the code is much nicer. You compare the element that you want to insert with the root of the tree. And if it's less than you insert in the left part. If it's EQ, then the tree doesn't change. And otherwise, you insert in the right part. So it's completely standard. And the isIn function is similar. It recurses down the tree using the comparison function to define if the element is in the tree. And then there's a delete function. The delete function that I've chosen here, what does it do? If you're here, you delete an element from the tree, and if you compare the element that you want to delete with the node in the element in the node, and you find equality, well, then basically you want to delete this element A, but you can't just delete it because then how do you combine left and right? Well, if right is empty, there's no problem. Then you can just return left. And if right is non-empty, then what you do is you take the smallest element in the right tree, so the leftmost element in the right tree, you bring it up to the node and you insert it into the middle here. So that's what happened here. So it's, again, the standard naive implementation of delete on binary search trees. And the emphasis wasn't on the code here. Except that I wanted to show you this comparison function that we're going to use in the future. But now we have to ask ourselves, what does correctness mean? And correctness makes sense if we have a specification. And so I will, in a moment, come to the abstract specification. But now, just intuitively, I will argue what is correctness. So why is the implementation correct? Well, because implicitly it should preserve a correspondence between the functionality on the tree level and the functionality on the set level. So that means you have here the interface, our abstract interface of the set data type, or the set implementation data type. It has to have these four functions. And on the other hand, you have the abstract functions on the sets that it's supposed to simulate, because we do have sets in Isabel, but they are, you could think of them as abstract mathematical structures, and here are programming interface functions, and empty is supposed to simulate the empty set, insert is supposed to simulate the union with a single element, delete is supposed to simulate the difference with a single element, and the isIn is supposed to simulate the element relationship. So that's the idea. And how does that concretely work out? Well, this simulation means that the set tree function should translate the result, if you do a computation on your tree level, to the abstract level, the set level. So if you do a computation, you take an empty, the implementation of the empty set, and now via the set tree function map it to the set, it should be the empty set. Similarly for insert, if you insert here on the tree level an element x into a tree t, and then you abstract that tree into the set of elements that you have, well then you should have the set of elements of the tree that you started with union the element that you put in. And the same for delete. If you perform the delete on the tree level and then look at the elements, well, that should be the elements beforehand minus the element that you deleted. So it's really a completely mechanical a relationship between the two levels, once you know what the abstraction function is and once you know which operation corresponds to which operation. Then you can write down these requirements mechanically. You don't have to think about them. Oh, and of course the last one is isIn. If you perform isIn on the tree level, it should be the same as checking on the set level that the element x is in the set represented by the tree t. And again, the set tree function is the one that translates between the two levels. Under one assumption, this is not going to work for an arbitrary tree.
A binary search tree.
Yeah, it has to be a binary search tree. And, of course, if you assume that T is always a binary search tree, then you need to make sure that this predicate is maintained by the operation. That is, that empty is indeed a binary search tree, and insert takes you from a binary search tree to a binary search tree, and similarly for delete. So we will use these invariants on data type representations a lot, and we will always have to show that they are invariants. And so you will have to additionally prove those three properties. And that is the, yeah.
And question again. And the lesson why we have the assumption, because intuitively I think the order in the binary search tree doesn't matter as long as the set is prevailing.
Right. Good question. So why do we have it? Let's look at an example. Let's look at the following tree that has a 1 here and has a 2 here and the rest, I don't know, I don't care about the rest. Yeah? This is not a binary search tree, right? So I claim that this binary search tree will not satisfy, for example, this equation, the last equation, because if you check isIn, whether 2 is in here, then the isIn function will go down here, and let's say that there's nothing here. Let's say it's empty here. Yeah? And then the isIn function will say, no, no, 2 is not in here. So the correct behavior does assume the binary search tree invariant. But yeah, do ask, because it may not immediately be obvious. Other questions? Right. So that's for the specific situation with our unbalanced binary search tree implementation, what you would have to do, what you would have to prove. I will briefly mention a slightly different method of doing things that improves automation, but I'm not going into the details. So here, what we have done, we have relied on the BST predicate, and instead you can express the binary search tree predicate a bit differently by not going all the way to sets, but going first to sorted lists. And so the key idea in this approach is that locally I will now for the next few slides mean sorted is sorted with respect to greater than or less than. That means there are no duplicates in there. And now you can express the BST predicate as the fact that the in-order traversal of the tree is sorted with respect to the greater than predicate. And the technical advantage is that you're now in the BST predicate, you have bounded quantifiers. If you go back, where's the definition? Oh, I think I shouldn't have gone back. You all know it. Here it is. So this is the BST predicate, and it has bounded quantifiers in it, and quantifiers typically are hard to automate. If you have formulas with quantifiers, it's typically a source of problems for automatic theorem provers. And so now what we've done, we've replaced the formulation with these quantifiers in it by a formulation that will not have any quantifiers in it. This one, we just talk about sorted in order traversals of trees, and that is just more convenient from an automation point of view. And then you can conduct the proofs on the list of on the level of sorted lists, and you don't need to talk about for all elements in some set. And then what you get, you get a distinction. Well, actually, that has nothing. This is. This is one thing, this idea of not using the BST predicate, but using this this other way of expressing the same thing. Then there's a second idea that comes into it, namely that so far our unbalanced binary trees had only just a single invariant, namely that it's a binary search tree. Typically, if you have more complicated balance, in some sense, trees, then you will have additional invariants, and we will call them the structural invariants on the trees that tell you, for example, how the height of the left and the subtree must be related and stuff like that. These two things behave differently. This binary search tree invariant, that we could express like this. And these structural invariants, they depend on the specific search tree data structure that you're looking at, and we won't be able to automate those. If you use correctness via sorted lists, as I just suggested we do, then the functional correctness of almost all the search trees covered in this course can be automated. And so that means that these theorems can be proved automatically. And these theorems can be proved automatically, except that you don't prove them with BST, you prove them with sorted for an in order. So that's, if we use this representation, then we can perform all these correctness proofs automatically, and therefore, but we can't do that for the structural invariants. The structural invariants, oh, if this node is red, then this one has to be black and stuff. That's not something I know how to automate. This is just very specific to a specific search tree data structure. And what we will therefore do in the rest of the course, we will not talk about the functional correctness and the preservation of the BST invariant, or hardly ever, and we will mainly concentrate on the structural invariants, because they are the ones that are tricky to automate and that are not so obvious. Oops. And yeah, this is just a literature reference. So that's an explanation of why I don't go into the functional correctness proofs, because also if you look at those algorithms, it is obvious that the that isin does the right thing insert does the right thing. What is usually not obvious is that the whatever balance criteria you may have, that they are maintained. And so that's what we're going to focus on. It does not mean that we ignore the other proofs. The other proofs have been done, but they can all be done in a completely mechanical way. There's no additional human intuition involved. And if you want to know how that works, you can read it up, but I'm not going to cover it. It's just the main idea is that you work on sorted lists as your intermediate level of expressing BST and other properties. So now I would like to finish today with stepping back from the specific example of search trees and unbalanced search trees and look more generally at what an abstract data type is and what it means to prove an implementation correct. So basically what I'm doing here, I'm going through the same material as before, but I'm no longer talking about tree, I'm talking about the generic interface and a generic specification, and then what does it mean to show that the interface is implemented by this, that the specification is fulfilled by the implementation. So this is a methodological interlude. It has nothing to do with search trees. But it helps you to understand how this is realized in the Isabel system. And the binary search trees will simply be an example. They will come up to concretize the material, but they are not. It's not specific to that at all. And we will ignore the delete function because it's just more of the same. So, what is an ADT? An ADT for me is simply an interface plus a specification. And here's the example, that's the set interface with the three operations empty, insert, and isin. And we assume that our abstract data types in fact always describe one specific type of interest, which we will call T. And in this case, up there, the type of interest is our type S, which is abstract. We haven't specified it. When I refer to T in the future, it means that is the type of interest that this specific interface is defining. And here, it's the type S that we're defining. And A, on the other hand, is just a parameter of the whole specification that stays polymorphic. Those are the elements, and the elements of the set, of course, they have to be always the same type, but you can have sets of different types. And the specification format that we'll be using is our so-called model-oriented specifications, and what the idea is here is that you specify the type of interest by a model. You give a model in HOL that tells you how this type of interest should behave. And the motto is here, your type of interest should behave like some already existing type in HOL, except that the existing type may be purely abstract mathematical or may be inefficient, and you want to now specify a possible more efficient implementations. And how do we say that the specification, how do we specify that the implementation, the type T, behaves like the specification, the type A, by an abstraction function? So whenever you have a specification, it should contain an abstraction function that relates your abstract type to some abstract mathematical type that already exists, to some model A, and here is the type T that you want to specify. And so, example, of course, where are we? Yeah, here is example of the set specification let me not jump ahead. So the specification behaves like some abstract object, some abstract type is specified via an abstraction function. And additionally, only some of the elements in your implementation may represent elements of A, and that is specified by invariant. So whenever you build specification, you should have, in addition to the interface, you should have an abstraction function that relates the types in your interface, the type of interest in your interface, to some abstract mathematical type, and you should have an invariant that tells you what are the allowed representations, or what are the valid representations of the abstract elements. And these are formally part of the interface, these two functions, the abstraction function and the invariant, but we're not programming with them, we're just proving with them. And here's the example, the set specification. So we have in our interface, we have a function set that takes us from the implementation type of our set data type to the abstract type, the actual sets, and we then we can use this set function to specify the behavior of all the other functions under the invariantness. And this, at this point, set and invar are already assumed to be part of the interface, and this is what it actually looks like in Isabel. So in Isabel, such a specification is called a locale, and you start out by fixing the interface, fixing the functions of the interface. So that's exactly what we saw before, except that you now have the keyword fixes here, but otherwise the type is exactly as we see before, empty, insert, and isInt. And the two additional functions, set that go from the implementation type S to the abstract type, set over type A, and also the invar that tells you the implementation type S what which elements are legal implementations of sets. So this would not be a legal implementation of a set. And that's your interface, and then comes the specification. And the specification are just the function that we saw before, the assumptions that we saw before, that set of empty is empty, the isIn behaves like the element modulo the set function, and the insert behaves like the union with a single element modulo the set function that abstracts from whatever implementation type S you have to the abstract set type alpha set. And of course, the invariant must be an invariant. It must be true for the empty set, and if it's true for S, it's also true when you insert an element. So this is the way you express such a specification, or in fact, express the abstract data type, meaning the interface plus the specification in Isabel. And this is now really an abstract data type because, in contrast to what I showed you concretely earlier on, where I used the set tree function that mapped trees to sets, here we just postulate there should be a set function from the implementation type S to the abstract type A set, and the set function the implementation should be correct modulo that set function. And you can see that in the library. And what does that? How does that look like really in general? We assume for ease of notation that our function alpha, the abstraction function, and the invariant, that is defined not just for the specific type of interest, but for all types. And we assume that alpha is simply the identity and invar is true on all the other types than T. So that just allows us to apply invar and alpha everywhere. And on types other than alpha, they don't do anything interesting. But if you have this notation, then you can actually, the specification of each interface function, F on our abstract data type, means F must behave like some function FA on A, can simply be interpreted like that if the invariant is satisfied for all the arguments T1 to TN, then applying F to those arguments and abstracting it afterwards is the same as abstracting the arguments first and then applying the abstract function to it. So if you compare this, this is the general schema, and a specific instance would be that the set function, our abstraction function for the set interface, applied to insert x s is equal to, now the insert function on the abstract level is just the union operation applied to the abstractions of the two arguments. So that should be set of S, union, and strictly speaking, we would have to write that. but because we want to mimic exactly the right-hand side where the abstraction function is applied to all the arguments, but x is not the type of interest, so on x the abstraction function is simply the identity, so we just drop it. It was just there for convenience to have a uniform notation and not having to distinguish the types in each formula. And so I'm just motivating that this line here, this equality, is the general schema that was behind the specific version that we saw before. And where do the invariants come in? Well, of course, this would be under the assumption that we have the invariant, let's call it, that would be BST. Let's call it invar. Yeah. Invariant of X and invariant of S. And again, we use the fact that the invariant is supposed to be true on types other than the type of interest, so we can just drop this and we get the actual formula that we used. And so, if you've been to an algebra course, then you have heard about homomorphisms, and in fact, that's all that is that we're doing here. We're postulating that there is a homomorphism from the concrete representation type to the abstract type. And we must also require that each function preserves the invariant. If all the arguments are invariant, then applying the function to it also has again this invariant property. So that's the generic look at abstract data types, independent of sets and trees and so on. But I think I should stop here. We will take it up again next time and then go on to actual concrete efficient implementations like 2-3 trees and red-black trees. That's it for today.